It's Saturday, March 4th, 2006, 10:06 a.m. on the central coast of California. Today's rundown, a bit of geek news, and your calls and questions of technology.
GeekSpeak is a production of KUSP, Central Coast Public Radio, kusp.org. The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com.
We're through being cool. We're through being cool.
Welcome to GeekSpeak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during GeekSpeak are not necessarily those of KOSP. Today on our program, we'll focus on some geek news, and then we were going to talk about, we've been promoing and talking about the Retro Gaming Hacks book. Unfortunately, the author did not call in, so we will be taking your calls and questions and filling you up with information about technology in the week of news. We've got a full cohort of geeks, and we're ready. During the second half of the show, and maybe a little sooner, we'll invite you to participate. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll free at 1-800-655-5877, or contact us now. Go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. I'll give out that contact information again when I invite your participation in about half an hour. GeekSpeak is supported by Henry J. Ramirez, DDS in Santa Cruz, specializing in cosmetic and family dentistry, using digital technology for less radiation, and offering one-appointment crowns and veneers. For appointments and more information, 423-2447. This is GeekSpeak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are geeks: Drew Meyer, product manager of Network Appliance; John Tracy, technical support engineer at Surf Control; and Miles Elam, his cohort, technical trainer at Surf Control. Welcome.
I'm his cohort now?
I'm sorry.
Time to stress?
You know, I'm trying to...
What is up with
the usual
that?
Cohort song.
You know, we like grasping for things to say?
Don't I always grasp for things to say?
This is the way it is.
Good morning, Lyle.
Good morning.
Glad to be here.
You know, it's interesting. Anytime the show changes pretty quickly before we get on the air, you know, when you're like counting down until the host, the guest calls in, and they don't call in, it's a different program. It feels a little different. But what we do have, we know we have, is some great geeks here in the house. Thank you guys for being here. And we got phone lines that we can open up later in the show. So we're totally set in that regard. We can help people with their problems. And we got a lot of news today, so I'm really excited about that. We knew that it was going to be kind of a percentage chance of the person coming. Not that bad a chance, but speaking of bad chances, I didn't do the segue well. Miles, what's going on in 96 years?
Well, it turns out that we're all going to die.
I think I'm going to die before 96 years.
Yeah, I'm not.
No?
Good. I'm going to live forever, at least until this asteroid hits.
He doesn't have kids, so that's actually a possibility.
Oh, that's true.
Oh, John.
There is an asteroid that has been tracked, and it is the size that it could take out a subcontinent, for example.
Australia is just... No.
It's big. Australia's a full continent.
What you're saying is it's not going to burn up before it hits us, right?
Right. And can do a fair amount of damage. But there is some good news. The good news being that, one, it would only occur 96 years. It's not our problem.
Oh, you mean it's on an intercept
course?
Unless
you have kids.
Right.
It's actually going to hit us, you think?
And then, whereas before... there's really only a 1 in 1,000 chance that it would cross the orbit of the Earth,
which is down from the 1 in 3,000 chance. So it's better now.
1 in 1,000.
Worse now. Worse now.
So in 96 years, there was an asteroid that we've known about for a while that in 96 years has a 1 in 3,000 chance, and recently it was upgraded. Regraded as a 1 in 1,000 chance.
Promoted
to hit us in 96 years, and
it's a 500-meter long asteroid, weighs about 1 billion tons.
Yeah, it will not destroy all life on the planet, just in a localized region.
Okay. Well, it's going to kick up a lot of dust. And probably
it's going
to
be bad.
Something equivalent to a nuclear winter.
But most likely it'll miss us.
Wow. It'd be like if we detonated every single nuclear weapon on Earth. Yeah. No, but, you know, it's only 1 in 1,000, so don't start packing your bags yet.
How much, this has happened in the past, right? In fact, I remember a near scare a few years ago.
You know, that was the one that we saw going away. Like, mm-hmm. Whoa, that was close. We didn't see that one coming.
Let's see. And it didn't hit us.
So. Yeah, 3 days after the fact, we're like, oh, hey.
Oh, speaking of which, I have a great follow-up story for this. Mm. NASA's budget just got cut.
Yay. 96 years by $3 billion. So
I hear we're pushing for visiting Mars, though.
Well, yeah,
so, John, what is the tally again for the budget with NASA? How did that timeline go?
Well, okay, back a few years ago, Bush said, yeah, we're going to go to Mars. This would be great. Or I can't imitate Bush.
Yeah.
He said, we're going to go to Mars, and I'm going to pledge $1 billion to go to Mars. NASA at that time was saying, we really need $5 billion just to keep going. So now Congress has come back a few years later, 3 years later, and said, Dan, we're also taking away the billion, and we're taking away two other billion. And I know you're growing by 3% a year, but... who cares? So they're cutting a bunch of cool programs that were going to be going out, like investigating dark matter, which is one of the things that they use to try to balance why do galaxies stay together? We don't really know. Maybe there's stuff called dark matter holding it together. We were going to send out a little probe to find that out.
Not going to do that.
We're not going to go explore for life under the ice of Jupiter's moon Europa. We're not going to go...
You know, space travel stuff, all these things... one side, I mean, the scientist side is like, yeah, we need to explore these things. We should be in space. We should be doing more. Blah, blah, blah. I mean, maybe the world's going to end when an asteroid hits us. If we don't get out there, we're going to be bad, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, the termination of the species as the planet loses its resources, because it probably will, and all of that. But then there's the aspect of me that's going, you know, there's people starving in the world, and maybe we could help them. So there's
in fairness, NASA is a fairly big, bloated bureaucracy that does a lot of things that aren't necessarily related to... the research that we think is cool.
Yeah, as they put in here, science at NASA has been disappearing.
Yeah.
Which is very true, unfortunately.
Doesn't sell, doesn't market as well, huh?
Yeah. So, still, write your congressman, Sam Farr. Say, you know, we would like to see...
Or
NASA's
whoever congressman is.
Yeah. Okay. I think actually Sam Farr is probably one of the... There was 56 congresspeople who said we would like to see a mandated 10% increase a year for NASA. I would love to see, like we were talking about, the pork removed from NASA and see it go back to being this is a science-based operation. Otherwise, we should be putting it into the hands of private firms.
All right. Whose news stories was that? That was Miles started. John finished.
I segued into it.
It's Drew's turn. Hi, Drew.
Well, it kind of points us back into one of my favorite topics, Boink and SETI at home, right? So you guys remember the Berkeley Open Infrastructure for Network Computing.
I'm sorry, Drew. I don't remember that particular...
let us talk about that. So Boink is a framework, and SETI at home is a project that runs on this framework.
SETI, hold your horse.
Okay.
Calm down.
Do you have any Christmas?
True, please.
Oh, wound up this morning.
Your butter voice is waiting for us.
So Boink is... So SETI at home is a project that analyzes radio signals collected from space, random things that are coming across our receivers, and looks for patterns within those signals, and those patterns may signify intelligent life out there in the universe. So it's a very esoteric, pure science-based project, and the magic is they do it on a shoestring budget by allowing you to run this application as your screensaver in the background on your computer, and anybody can download this little piece of scientific, this little project. So all of us in here could be running it on their computers, and you could run it at home. You could run it at work while your computer's sitting there idle. If it's turned on and it's at your office right now, it could be analyzing this data for the scientists at SETI at home. Well, they had so much success. Millions of people downloaded this project and started analyzing the data that they built this Boink framework so that they could have other people take their own scientific projects and run them in the same fashion. So now Boink is up to about 9 or 10 different projects, and one of the most interesting ones that I think about is climateprediction.net, and that is a project that works on analyzing giant, complicated, very complex models of what's happened in the Earth's climate over the history. See, the whole point of this is to gather computer cycles, because it's really expensive to buy one giant, massive computer and dedicate it to your project.
Well, and there's a lot of projects to run. I mean, there's a lot of other projects to run, right?
Yeah, and so by piggybacking on everybody's personal computer out there, you can really crunch a ton of numbers, teraflops of numbers at a time.
And lots of times people like to leave their computers on, so the idea is that when you're not really using the computer, this is when it's functioning.
Yeah, bear in mind, this is not hacking. This is you're volunteering.
You're donating your PC cycles, or your computer power.
So what is the weather one called?
So the newest one is called Climate... Well, it's not the newest one, but it's just gotten some really interesting press, because the British Broadcasting Company, the BBC, has done a documentary on a climate change experiment, and they're going to analyze revise a climate model using data from 1900, essentially the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, to the year 2000. It'll take an average machine about 3 or 4 months, and then it'll everybody's results will be returned to the central computing point and tabulated, and we'll have a simulation of the of what climate change has happened in the past and what might happen in the future.
Wow, that sounds like a wonderful project.
So okay, so pretty interesting.
So if you want to do more of the, if you want to add the screensaver to your computer, where do you go?
If you want to do the...
you can probably go to climate.
If you go to climateprediction.net or just go to the, search for the BBC and climate, then you'll find it. BBC.cpdn, Charlie, Peter, Delta, November.org will give you right onto the site.
Thank you, Drew, for that story. I'm going to go back to...
I actually have a segue from
Please do.
Speaking of climatology and change, Jupiter's got a new spot.
A new spot?
Yeah, they're calling it Red Junior or the not-so-great red spot. Or its official name is Oval BA. I think Red Junior is much better.
Yeah, me too.
They've been watching. The original spot, it's about 300 years old. It's a giant storm about twice the size of Earth on Jupiter. It's red.
Oh, is that all?
Yeah.
How much the size of Earth?
About twice the size of Earth.
The Junior spot is?
The big spot.
Okay.
The little spot is not quite that large yet. It happened when three different storms collided. This happened from about 97 to 2000. In 2000, it was a white storm. Last November, they watched it kind of turn into a brown storm, and just last week, it turned into a red storm. So they're trying to figure out why.
And so they know the durations of time it took to change.
Exactly. Yeah, they see. Sometimes the white spots on Jupiter, which are storms, do kind of turn reddish, but then they usually dissipate. This is another one. This is three storms that all came together. So it was neat. We kind of got to see how we think the red storm happened on Jupiter.
Very cool.
Right, that's and it's cool. A point of reference that the big spot on Jupiter isn't a permanent fixture. It's actually something that's about 300 years old. So people who lived in the year 1700 would have seen a new spot, if they had a powerful enough telescope at the time, would have seen a new spot form on Jupiter.
Which is just a storm that, for some reason, exists for a long period of time.
Or had other spots there that have since dissipated.
The Exploratorium has this great little model of how this happens. They have this giant sphere. It's almost a meter in diameter, and it's just filled with this, I don't know, this stuff. It's this liquid stuff, and you spin the sphere, and it striates into different bands, and you see at the edges little storms form.
Oh,
it shows
cool.
perfectly how Jupiter
works. Yeah. Oh, wonderful. All right, giving away a book. A high school student can call in and tell me what the name of the new spot on Jupiter is, and we'll give you a retro gaming book and a t-shirt, extra large t-shirt for you high school students that need extra large t-shirts, or anybody that wants to sleep in a t-shirt. Okay, you're listening to Geek Speak. Oh. Yeah, I'll give the phone number in a second. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. With me in the air are geeks Miles, John, and Drew. And we're talking about geek news, and pretty soon we'll be taking your calls. And for those that want to call in to try to get that shirt, book, we'll take the first three high school students, and we'll give you a book and a shirt. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. So you got to be a high school student. You got to listen to Geek Speak right now, KOSP. And you got to call up Rick. And in about 10 minutes or so, we'll invite everybody else to call in with technical questions and comments. Phone numbers again, 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. All right. Oh, high school or younger, by the way, you know.
Do they all need to answer the question? Because it's one question.
Yeah, they just answer the question.
Okay.
Yeah. Which is, what's the name of the spot on Jupiter?
The
new spot on Jupiter.
Which name?
Well, any name.
Anyone. Any name.
Yeah.
Okay. Actually, if you just call us and ask us for the book, it's probably odds are pretty good.
Since the phone lines aren't ringing.
At the moment.
At the moment.
They will when we open it up. All right. So, you know what? That brings me back into, actually, that has nothing to do with it, but I'm so stoked on this Boink thing lately. Let me throw one other story out here.
Now, Boink's a distributed thing running your laptop, right?
Boink is the, it's a subtle differentiation. Boink is the platform, and there's all kinds of projects about AIDS research, projects about...
Yeah, so Drew's going to steal one of my stories.
Yeah, let's let Miles... Oh, I'm sorry. Wait a minute. No, I stepped all over you there.
No, that's all good, man. Go ahead.
I'll be done and out of the way here. And you might like this one, too. So the thing is, some guy on his website decided to design a little piece of software, and this is not Boink-related, but it's distributed computing, so that anybody could go download it and it would crunch numbers. Now, the project that he designed was a decoder for the German...
Wait, this is Miles' story.
No, it's perfectly all right. I have another story that's much better anyway.
Okay, I see. I see what the confusion was. Yes, Miles had told us a little bit about this before the show, before he showed up, but I get it. So go on. He made a thing like Boink that crunches
numbers.
He made
this piece of software that crunches numbers, and he kind of took on this project to decode the German World War II U-boat Enigma code. Which was how the Germans communicated with each other.
One of the major reasons why we won the war is we were able to decode that.
Not all of them. The British had a decoding project, a cryptography project at Bletchley Park in the UK, and they were successful in a few of the messages, but they really didn't have it down. And so the Germans were able to continue to communicate in code throughout the entire war. In fact, there was a movie not long ago, kind of a dorky movie, but, well, my opinion was it was a dorky movie. About the U-boat, then they captured the Enigma machine. It was a big deal. So,
yeah, during the course of the war, the Enigma machines were constantly changing. Not just the cipher, but the actual hardware was being swapped out, different parts, different,
It was a very clever design.
So and these guys are still trying to crack these...
Well, this guy decided, let's see what happens. So in about 60 years after the end of the war, he put this project up, and on February 20th, he announced that the first message had been broken. By all this free computing power that's just sitting around out there, and people decided, let's try this. And sure enough, bam! They broke the Enigma code.
What did the message say? Send more donuts.
Forced to submerge during attack. Depth charges. Last enemy position. Such and such. Following the enemy. Military type messages. Thing. But there was a guy who was a German fellow who was a captain of a U-boat, and he was among 52 survivors of the depth charge attack. And they found out that this is exactly what he wrote at the time, and confirmed
this is
his message. Yeah.
Okay. Wow. So, thank you, Drew, for enlightening us on that. There's three Enigma puzzles still left, right? So now there's
two of them left.
Two more messages.
And
there's about 5,000 computers participating in the project. If you look up M4 message breaking on Google, then you'll find the site.
I'm assuming that this M4 project in cracking this is just brute force, just going through it until they find the cipher.
They've done a couple of things to reduce the total problem set.
Okay.
But yeah, it is a brute force cracking. Things that people never got around to, and then finally people forgot about it. Computers came into the fore where everyone could do this type of project, and
let's do it.
Throw it at it, yeah.
And it's historical and kind of interesting, and it's a whole about cryptography. There's a lot of interest in about cryptography. Okay, Miles, you had mentioned just a moment ago that you've got a story that's even better, so now you got to live up to your promise, man.
Yes. Now, see, this has absolutely nothing to do with any previous story, so it's no segue.
What a relief.
I think we should stop trying to segue, and I'll just say, next news story, Miles. Because we're doing such a great job of it.
This past February... an individual by the name of Stephen Heller was charged in Los Angeles Superior Court with felony access to computer data, commercial burglary, and receiving stolen property. And he pleaded not guilty. Now, you would think, okay, what's the story behind that?
You know, I was just thinking, what's the story behind this?
Right. He used to be a word processor working at the legal firm known as Jones Day, who happened to be the attorneys for the electronic voting company, Diebold.
Okay.
While he was, through the course of his job, came across some memos that were between two lawyers at Jones Day saying that there were some possible issues with the voting machines, that they may not pass muster with regard to California voting law, that they were not properly certified, and whether or not the state... California Secretary of State had the authority to investigate the company.
So it was kind of doing this lawyer who's working for a firm who actually represents.
Well, no, he was a word processor. He was just a general person doing data entry, or transcribing information is more likely.
And he decided to be a good citizen and share this information with the public,
right? And then send it to a press firm. Oakland Tribune.
Does it look like the story has merit that those things are true that Diebold was doing things
Alameda
wrong.
County was, in fact, suing Diebold.
So this helped
over,
their case?
Yeah, and there were cases where unverified machines were being used in elections.
One of the laws about this is that the person that makes the machine, the company that makes the machine, submits it and gets it approved, kind of certified
it goes
as
through
a good voting
machine. A series
machine.
Of review.
And that means that it theoretically is working.
Right.
And that what they had done is they'd upgraded, what I'd heard stories and such, that they'd upgraded code and they'd changed things about the box and didn't go through that certification process again, therefore breaking the law pretty blatantly. So there's certain districts that use the machines.
Well, there was a settlement involved, so there's no admission of guilt involved.
I see. But, so they did something really wrong.
But the idea that a lot of people are bringing up is that this is a case of a whistleblower. In other words, a person saw these documents and, according to his attorney, Blair Burke, certainly someone who saw these documents could have reasonably believed that thousands of voters were going to be potentially disenfranchised in upcoming elections. So it's that question of, would this person be liable, in which case it would really scare people in the future who came across this, or is this a public interest story where people should know that there's something wrong with the electronic voting machines that are being used in your district?
So the basic argument that this guy has against this lawsuit is that he was acting the public good.
And that he should fall under the whistleblower laws.
Yes. Right, right. And that's why it's a civil suit rather than a...
Right. But at the same time, actually, no, this is a felony.
So it is.
This is a criminal case. At the same time, this is... he was working for a law firm, and a law firm has that confidentiality with their...
So he might be breaking a confidential agreement.
But, I mean, he's not their lawyer.
But he's not a lawyer, and he can't be disbarred. He's not a lawyer.
Yeah, well, it's not that. But, I mean, it calls into all sorts of sort of legal questions of
or maybe a court organization with some money starts defending him, because he's doing the right thing. We need to know about the voting problems that exist. It's just an important thing. Miles, thank you for that story. I'm going to go over to Mr. Tracy. John, hi.
Hi.
How's it going, man?
It's going good.
You got another story for us?
Well, I was trying to figure out how to blend Spore into a story here.
Oh, don't blend Spore. It in. Just talk about it.
Yeah, just talk about it. I first saw this when one of our geeks in absentia, Chris Dumphy, sent a link out for a Google video to this talk given by Will Wright about this game called Spore. Will Wright, for those of you who don't know him, came up with these games called SimCity, SimEarth, SimAnt.
Oh, those are kind of popular.
The Sim. Oh. Yeah, I think there's actually a 12-step program for Sims, which are to recover. Our former producer, Maggie Cleveland, is still on. He came up with this great idea for a video game. You start as a microbe, basically in a Petri dish, and you float around eating things. And he said, and you know, he admits at this level it's like Pac-Man. You gain enough energy by eating things, and you know, there's things trying to eat you too. And it's very well rendered, and it's all done in procedural. It's
meaning
not
that the shapes that exist were never drawn. They
exactly.
were mathematical algorithms.
You don't create them. Yeah, you don't actually build the shapes. It's all based on a mathematical algorithem that creates the shapes. And then it
emulates life kind of. Extrapolates.
Thank you. It extrapolates how that creature is going to move based on the skeleton, based on the limbs,
but
all of that.
At that point, it doesn't have a skeleton.
Well, it has a...
It has a form of locomotion.
It has bits. When you get enough energy, you can lay an egg. The egg allows you to then go into the creature editor. And from that point, you can add different parts to your creature, so it can do different things. And that goes on, and as you evolve this creature, it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And eventually, it pulls away from this little 2D Petri dish overview that you've got into more of a 3D like first-person shooter or World of Warcraft kind of view. And it's the same thing. You're running around eating things and growing, getting energy. And
but in this case, you're like an amphibian far up the chain
you get more energy, you get more tools, more things that you can add to your creature, and eventually you can evolve and go on to land. And then you keep, you know, and as he says, you keep saving up money, so to speak, or, you know, energy or whatever, to build a better and better brain until you evolve into a sentient being. At that point, the game changes, and it becomes like civilization, almost like SimCity, actually, where you're building a village and then a town, and you have different tools that you can do to do that.
And you can play God from scratch, basically, right? That's the whole game.
It goes from the microbe all the way up to the galactic.
And the game is definitely... intelligent design. You know, you get to control every evolutionary step. You get to add limbs, take away limbs. So it's kind of cool.
And
one of the amazing things, of course, is at this level where you get like your civilization is strong enough to build a flying saucer, and then you can go to other planets. Then the other, and actually the entire time, other species that you run into are actually downloaded from other people playing the game. You get copies of their creatures.
It's asynchronous multiplaying, which means that it's looking around for other computers where people have created societies, creatures, whatever. It's downloading the models for those and then trying to emulate how those would act based on the options that the person who created that civilization made. Yeah. But they're not really playing that civilization. It's downloading the information so that it's on your computer. So you're interacting with these civilizations that are totally different from anything you've created.
Wow.
Very cool.
So go check out video.google.com and search for Spore, best game ever.
Yes.
And it will pop up.
Is that the official title?
It's in the text description, so it should come up in a search.
GeekSpeak is proudly sponsored by Business with Pleasure, a full-service business center in Felton, offering color printing, design, computer rentals, delivered office supplies, shipping via FedEx, UPS, DHL, and more. Details at businesswithpleasure.com. You're listening to GeekSpeak. Our phone answer and fellow web geek, Rick Filman, awaits your call of questions or comments. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can do it the geeky way by going to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. This program is supported by Cruise.io, providing local and nationwide internet services, including DSL 6.0, spam filters, and virus protection. Information about Cruise.io membership is available online at cruise.io.com or by calling 459-6301. You're listening to GeekSpeak. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the room with me, the other brains, or most of the brains, John Tracy, Drew Meyer, and Miles Elam. And Miles, I want to say thanks and welcome back. You've been gone for about a month, and I know everybody's been missing you. I've been seeing you regularly. But,
you were gone?
A month?
Oh.
Wait, hold on. A month?
A month? I didn't
Three
realize
shows
been
is
a month.
Pretty much a month, right? I mean, yeah. Okay, I'm sorry, man. I count all durations by times of GeekSpeak, you know. So a fortnight isn't really true. It's two GeekSpeak.
So we had the Imperial System, the Metric System, and the Lyle GeekSpeak System.
Yeah, exactly. Please join the conversation. We're fun, we're friendly, and we won't make fun of you. But we will make fun of each other, obviously. Please join the conversation. The phone number is 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. And you can go to the internet, click on Contact Us. And you know what? Rick just says to me, we got no callers at this point. You know what that means? It means that you can call us with any technical question and we'll take your call. But it also means that if you're pre-college and learning, how's that? you can get a free book from us. We got some books. O'Reilly sent some books and some t-shirts. We got two Retro Gaming Hacks books. And we got one Google Maps Hacks, which we talked about last week. And they're yours if you call in and tell Rick what the new storm on Jupiter is. What's it called? Any common name, any official name. Okay, there's three calls. There you go.
Or make up a name.
So this is open to anyone who is legally bound to attend school at this point in their life.
If you have ever seen a school.
if you know what a school is, if you can understand what I'm saying. All right, we're going to take calls now and help you out. But I want to mention something that happened last week, which I thought was... you know, we got this regular listener, Lee from Amsterdam. He listens to us on our streaming. I don't know if he's doing podcasting with us or not. We do podcasts as well as the station, of course, are doing podcasting. You can learn all about that by going to kusp.org. But Lee says last week we talked, or maybe 2 weeks ago, we talked about hard drive recovery software and like what to do. And he suggests two that he likes. So here they are. For recovering your data on a hard drive that's get data back, which is one word, but using camel case. And camel case is the meaning that every word in that is actually capitalized. So get data back, the G, the D, and the B is capitalized. Anyway, I don't know what the URL is, but it's get data back. And the other software is called active-undelete. So active-undelete. And I'm assuming a search for both those will hook you up. So if you're looking to recover your data, of course you can give us a ring. We'll try to help you out over the phone. There's a whole thing with a freezer, but I won't get into that unless somebody calls about it. Anybody else got...
I got a story here.
Yeah? All right.
Let's see. There's been some discussion recently that you guys may have heard about where the FCC is saying it's possible that they may allow cell phones on airplanes, which...
FAA.
Sorry, FAA. And the FCC.
Oh, really?
The FCC recently did a study about what might happen and what's really happening today. Now, I travel pretty frequently for my business, and I cannot stomach the idea of people talking on their cell phones on an airplane while I have to sit there and listen. Especially on cross-country flights.
Yeah.
So I'm not a very big proponent of this, but I know people who are excited about it. The interesting thing is that So the reason why you can't talk on your cell phone today on the airplane is because there's some concern that the radiation emanating from your cell phone might interfere with the tracking information that's happening between the airplane and ground control.
You know, Drew, I love that you're like, you know, you're a geek, you're a scientist, you use the term radiation, and which is completely accurate in every single way and scares people to death.
No, sorry, but, signals. Maybe that's a better
the
way.
The signals coming from the cell phone, yes. Yeah. The radiation. Anyway,
the little particles that are shooting around.
That it might do something to the plane?
Well, that'll interfere with the signals that are coming from the cockpit going down to ground control, and there might be some kind of confusion, and information might not be transferred between the two accurately.
And the thing is, you know, there's...
In essence, you could crash the plane by talking on your phone, okay?
But there's basically no chance of that happening.
Yeah.
That's the thing.
Some pilot's going to notice they're plummeting to the Earth.
Yeah. How did that happen? Someone called their mother. Well, so the FCC and the FAA got together, and they did a little survey saying how many people are actually violating this ban today. And surprisingly, or not surprisingly enough, it looks like passengers are using cell phones on the average at least once per flight, contrary to regulations, and sometimes during the especially critical flight phases of takeoff and landing.
Uh-oh, people know it doesn't affect
People don't buy it. Yeah.
I do have to admit.
Or they're just so selfish they don't care.
I have left my cell phone on during a takeoff once. I got on the plane.
Oh,
I'm
sure people do that all the time.
I went to sleep.
Right?
You know, was kind of like waking up. We were already in the air, and I realized my cell phone's still on.
Oh my God, the plane's going to crash.
But we already got past takeoff. And I was just like, oh, well.
Oh, well, no one called.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great experiment, Miles. Thanks a lot.
Like I said, man, I was tired.
I don't fly with you, buddy.
It was a late flight.
The thing is, if cell phones could do that, that's an attack someone could do on a plane. You know, you just take a cell phone and you jam the signals.
And call it
frequently.
The
truth of the matter is that you can't. I mean,
yeah,
it's just
but it also
that.
Means that with people, I'm not saying to the audience members that they should be doing this, but with the fact that there were this many people who had their cell phones on, that if it did affect electronics, that
very likely we would have known.
Every once per flight, there's a lot of flights in this country every
but
day.
You know, from the social perspective, who wants to hear? It's different having your phone on and everything, but if Drew was sitting next to you and you started talking, he'd just start hitting you, and you don't want to deal with that.
Yeah, Drew's a big guy.
Drew is a mean guy. You don't want to mess with him.
Consider, too, that the FCC's been studying this, and they're expected to issue a ruling on the subject later this year. Now, several foreign airlines are using Boeing's connection Wi-Fi service, which I think would be extremely useful, on international flights, although the FCC has withheld that permission for U.S. flights so far. So that means you could sit there in your seat and get on the internet surfing from your notebook using a wireless connection, which I think is much less onerous than having somebody yakking about their girlfriend.
Until someone fires up Skype.
And starts shouting at their notebook. Yeah.
All right, we're going to start taking calls.
Headphones, it's not that hard.
From Los Gatos, Mike, welcome to Geek Speak.
Oh, hi. Yeah,
hi, sorry to surprise you.
Yeah, this is Mike in Los Gatos.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I had a question. I'm kind of rebuilding my computer at home. I had built it originally myself. And, and one thing I had a question, you know, with the... there's something about if you configure the C drive, make it like a... format it to be a small partition and put the Windows on that. It'll make it run faster. And... But then I wondered if there's a way to force like people's home directories to be on a different
drive
letter.
The My Documents that gets installed, maybe put it on a separate drive.
What's your concern, Mike? You want a performance maximization here?
Yeah.
Right. Okay, well, if it's one hard drive, you're not going to get a performance differentiation at all. If you
I'm going to put several on there.
Because the data is still being read from the same drive.
It's same head has to run around all over the drive.
One thing that I used to like to do quite a bit is partition the drive and put a certain amount of space. It always grew for Windows, and then everything else was on another drive. But I never really changed my home documents. I just didn't use that. And that's a kind of geeky thing to do, and it gets
kind of
messy.
Have multiple users, each of the default documents is set to C.
To C, and then you start running out of space. And then there's the whole issue of... And the reason I did that is the idea is that the stuff on C, I don't care about. It can totally get destroyed. The stuff on D is my important data. But then, you know, my wife does it such that she just uses the default space that Microsoft sets out to her, and I know that her documents folder is important, and I just make sure to copy that too.
Yeah.
So I think that the difficulty and the challenges of doing that, it's not worth it.
Is it possible?
Well, I'm the native.
It's totally possible. But really what you're talking about is, what Lyle's talking about is protecting his data. And you can
kind of
do that by
organizing it too.
You can put it in two physical locations, or you can have two directories and folders. As long as you back up those two points, that's the best thing to do.
The important aspect is to understand on your computer what is the operating system and the applications that you have copies of and you can reinstall, and what is the data that you don't want to lose. That's the most. That's the reason.
You were
talking
about speed, though. So
it's not going to affect it at all.
Yeah,
right?
With regard to speed,
I have an idea.
I would say the best way to speed up your hard drive access is to paradoxically enough, add more RAM to your system.
Yeah.
Because what that will do is reduce the amount of hard drive access, and thus, you know, you're spending more time in RAM and less time on the hard drive. So
I'm having a deja vu.
What you're doing right now, like, I don't want to dissuade you, because it would be, you know, a nice exercise. You learn a lot about using your computer in different configurations. But if you're really looking for adding speed, I think you're going to put in a lot of effort that's not going to give back the results you're looking for.
I agree.
Yeah, okay. And what about when you install a new application, putting those on a separate hard drive?
No.
So consider if your OS gets a problem, if you get a virus or you delete a system file by mistake, and you have to reinstall your machine, you want to, it'd be simpler to just reinstall the operating system and not all the applications, or just some of that at a time. And that's one reason you might separate it out across different drives.
Except that doesn't really work.
Yeah.
Because most Windows programs nowadays install so many things into the registry, into random directories, that there's no possible way, especially Office.
I'm like in the Windows situation that the people that tune it and fine-tune it and stuff really know what they're doing, and they really like to do it. And if you don't really know what you're doing, you don't like to do it, just go with the defaults. That's kind of my feeling. And that's what I do at this point.
If you want to learn more, feel free to definitely tweak. But at the same time, behind every great geek is a dozen smoldering boxes.
There's one thing if you're building it. Yeah. We've got a lot of broken hardware.
Smell mine right there.
The other thing to note, if you do want faster hard drive, you know, you want a faster computer, one of the things you can do, besides adding lots of RAM, have a good processor, is you can get a faster spindle drive. And that's like, get a 10K drive. They're going to be more expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And they're normally rated for servers, and therefore they're going to last longer. Maybe. In any case, that's one thing you can do, is the faster hard drive. But again,
buy more RAM.
You won't see it.
More RAM will do so much more than the speed of the...
Agreed.
Thank you, Mike, for the call. Good luck on the building.
You're welcome. Thanks a lot. Okay, bye.
Bye.
I hope we helped the poor guy. We just went off on our own opinions.
You know, it entertained me, so we're good. Watsonville, Judith, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi, yeah. I just wanted to call up. I recently found out that Diebold voting machines, some of them have been conditionally certified for use in the 2006 elections here in California, and let people know there's more information about that at the Secretary of State's website.
And what is that website?
If you can search California Secretary of State.
Okay,
Bruce,
to learn more about
Bruce McPherson, and I think it's in the voting. I forget. I searched through.
Was it an interesting read?
Well, I was looking at it. I mean, people that are a little more geeky than I might be able to understand some of this stuff better. I think there's another group or something I've gotten some information from. I think it's like open voting.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure exactly where. Previously, I had gotten a document about the history of Diebold's machines in California, other machines.
It's a pretty compelling story.
And it's pretty, yeah. And I just wanted to encourage people to
research it a bit.
To look into it and to maybe try and talk with the, you know, communicate with the Secretary of State's office with their concerns.
Judith, thank you very much for the call.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
If anyone is concerned about voting, they can go to blackboxvoting.org. I mean, different voting machines. Blackboxvoting.org. It's kind of a canted one way, definitely.
Yeah, they are very slanted, but you know, for that slant, they do a job very well.
Yeah, they do usually have some useful information. If you can dig through the conspiracy theory part of it, they do actually have some useful information.
You mean somebody believes the government's not telling us the whole story? The absolute
Well,
truth?
Everyone, you know, accepts that.
Because.
It's just a... Yeah. Anyway,
we're gonna.
George didn't know about Katrina. What are you talking about?
We're losing some people here and there, which is a shame. I think my mother just called in and we lost her phone line, which is a shame. But possibly not. Maybe it's another Diana from Cottonwood. In any case, we're gonna go now to. So if you got dropped off and you got a good question, please go ahead. Feel free to call back. All right, Ted. Good. We'll get to you in a second. And Bruce from Seaside, welcome to GeekSpeak. What's your question?
Okay. Actually, I got three of them, but they're all short.
Okay.
One. What was the name of the book that the author was on a couple of weeks ago on people doing amazing things?
It's called Makers.
Makers?
Makers from O'Reilly. Really cool book.
Makezine.com or .org, you guys, do you remember?
Well, you could just go to geekspeak.org if you'd like.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the third story down on the bottom, I mean, on the page.
Oh, okay, great.
Yeah. What's your second question?
Makezine.com,
Movie software. We finally got a computer in the office that runs XP, because we're a bunch of Linux geeks here, and we were wondering, it doesn't play all the movies on all the DVDs. Is there any kind of movie software you would recommend?
So you put in a DVD and it doesn't play?
That's right.
Does it say it's the wrong...
Codec?
Wrong...
Or country?
don't have the right codecs.
Okay.
Okay. So you want to
unfortunately.